Life Audio.
Welcome to the March or Die show today. Very glad to have you joining me. And today we are going to discuss an issue that I have certainly talked about before, but we're going to take a deep dive into the topic or the issue specifically of suicides in the first responder community. This is something that, again, I have talked about in my work with the Mighty Oaks Foundation and the work that we do with veterans. This is a topic that we're always dealing with. In talking about those issues with veterans and the military, we then talk about those in the first responder community. But today we're going to take a deep dive, talk about some numbers, talk about the reasons these things happen, the steps or the other issues that would lead up to people making that decision to take their lives. This is such an important issue. And it's one I'm grateful I have a great guest on with me today to really unpack. On the other side of talking about the issue, we're going to talk about how to move forward and offer a ton of resources that are available as well, because many people struggle with this. It's great to know there's a problem, but it's better to know what we do with that problem, how we move forward. And so we're going to talk about that when we come back in just a moment.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Again, welcome to the March or Die show, and I am, again, so happy to be able to have this conversation today. It is a heavy conversation for a lot of folks, for sure, but it is a very, very important conversation. When we talk about issues like suicide, and we talk about the challenges around working in the first responder community, in law enforcement, in the fire community, in the EMT, paramedic world, some very unique challenges. But at the end of the day, they are challenges that bring about feelings, emotions, decisions that sometimes are not good decisions. How do we deal with that? How do we identify it? How do we understand it? What are some resources that are available for those in the first responder community? And I'm excited to be able to talk about that. Before we jump into that, though, I will remind you, as I do every single week, if you're not yet subscribed to the show, please go ahead and subscribe. Whatever podcast platform you're listening from, subscribe right now. That helps me. That will help you. And love to have you joining this conversation. My guest today is actually a good friend of mine. We have been friends for a number of years. These are issues, I think I mentioned this in our interview, these are issues that we talk about a lot and have talked about a lot over the years. We've just never sat down and hit record to share these conversations with other people. But my guest is Danny Kuhn. Danny is a retired L.A. County Sheriff's deputy, served in L.A. County for 31 years. Before that, he was a military police officer in the United States Army. His career, not only does it span a length of time where he could see stages and phases of law enforcement, how law enforcement deals with these various issues, but he was in different areas. Los Angeles County, of course, is huge, and so served in some very inner city, very violent areas, served in some other wealthier, kind of higher end areas, higher end, I don't know, where wealthier people lived, but was able to see this kind of issue or these issues from so many different aspects, and then became aware after retirement of the problem and then the growing problem with not only suicide, but with depression and relationship issues and health issues and all of these things. Started to write about it, has been writing his blog for a number of years, and is now interviewed a lot, and it really has made himself an expert in these areas and these issues. It's funny, knowing Danny, you know, personally, my son's in law enforcement, he's a police officer, and Danny has been kind of there through the whole process. So really spending time with him as he was talking about going to law enforcement in the academy. Danny came to his academy graduation, spent time with him there, and helping him since then. So when I say he knows what he's talking about and he cares about those who are doing the work, he does both of those things. And I'm very grateful to be able to have this conversation and share this with you. So please, without further ado, as they say, my conversation with my guest and my friend, Danny Kuhn. Danny, thank you for joining me this morning. Great to see you.
Good to see you, Jarman. I want to thank you for having me as your guest today. I'm deeply honored.
Oh, for sure. You have, and you know, people wouldn't know this, but you've helped me an awful lot, even in my understanding of some of the topics we'll talk about today. And more important, you've been a good friend for a while. We've been friends for quite a while. And it's funny because we talk about this stuff all the time. Right? We just never hit record while we were doing it. So this is kind of that, which is awesome.
Yes, yeah, so we do feed off of each other. So. I like to steal your stuff. You steal my stuff.
Yeah, right. I forward your stuff as mine. Let's just start with your career. You have a long career in law enforcement, in a big, very busy department and kind of a crazy areas where you ended up working. How'd you get into law enforcement? I know you were in the military first. And then talk about your career. Your time spans over some pretty significant events.
Yes, it does. It all started back in probably about 1966, 67-ish. My dad, we'd moved to Santa Ana, which is in Orange County. Yeah. And my dad became a reserve police officer for the city of Santa Ana. And that was all about the same time. Some of the Adam 12s were just coming out, and I remember seeing him in one uniform one day, and I thought, I want to do that. And since law enforcement is a God-ordained profession, and you can go back into Romans 1 or Romans 13, 1 through 5, and it'll tell you. But I eventually got into scouting, became an Eagle Scout, one of the youngest Eagles, or at the time, the youngest Eagle Scout in Orange County. Wow. And when I turned 14 years old, I joined the Orange Police Department Explorer program, and then you can join at 14, but you were forced out at 18 because it was still part of the Boy Scouts. And when I turned 18, I left the Explorers as a sergeant, and graduated from high school, wanted to get into law enforcement. I go, hey, why not join the Army and be a military policeman?
It's the best of both worlds, or the worst, however you look at it, I guess.
It was great. You know, the recruiter did a good job. He came to one of our Explorer meetings, and he did a great job of selling. So I drank the Kool-Aid, got in an airplane on December 29th in 1975, landed in St. Louis, Missouri in a snowstorm and didn't see asphalt for 4 or 6 weeks.
Yeah, wow.
Because of snow and ice.
Yeah.
Was a military police, was stationed back in place called Fort George Meade, Maryland. That's where NSA is, headquarters is. I was there for a little over a year, and then transferred to Fort Ord, where I went to a place right out up in Monterey County, southern Monterey County, called Fort Hunter Liggett. Now at Fort Meade, that was a combat unit, so we did both garrison MP work and whatever they do in the combat. I used to say we'd go camping with the Army because that's what we did. The food was bad, but conditions were just right for an 18-year-old kid.
Sure, sure.
Unless it snowed. And then when I was back in California, it was a straight garrison assignment, and so we were out looking for bad guys, you know, doing regular police work stuff. And then when I got out of the Army, I applied for the California Highway Patrol. They were hiring at the time. And at the same time, I was going to college, and I have an AA degree in law enforcement. Right after I got out of college, I saw that, for the longest time, I had heard that LAPD and LA sheriffs were hiring. And I go, man, I'm an Orange County kid. I don't want to go to LA, and it's not going to work. And finally, someone spoke to me from a higher power. And it wasn't my dad. So it was another father from my
I was going to say, was that your dad?
No. And I applied for and was hired by the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department.
Yeah.
I was hired in November of 1981, the day before Thanksgiving. Oh. And I retired in March of 2013. So I did, 31 years and 4 months.
Yeah. Wow.
And it was a fun career. It was great. I did. I was one of the lucky ones. I only went to jail for 9 months. Prior to when I got hired, the average jail sentence for a new deputy was about 3 years. And
and you weren't there as a prisoner. You were there as a corrections officer, right?
As a jailer. And in the late 81, going through 1982, the Olympics was coming up, and the sheriff decided to boost up his patrol stations. And, so a bunch of people got out of jail early, and we were all happy for it. So I went to a place called, Limita Station. It's on the Palos Verdes Peninsula, and it's kind of a mix of both worlds. And 1 minute you can be in the dredges of San Pedro, because some of the county areas there, which is no different from, South Central LA. And then the next minute, you're walking into a multi-million-dollar house owned by some movie stars. Well, Chuck Norris's house. I've been in his house a couple of times.
Yeah, right.
Breaking up parties. His kids have great parties.
Yeah.
And spent a couple of years there. Went to East Los Angeles, which is the epicenter of the Latino gangs. Spent 4 years there. Another great career. Was a training officer there. For some reason, one of my friends talked me into transferring up to Lancaster with him. So up to the Antelope Valley, to worked Antelope Valley Station for 9 years, got tired of the desert and got a job as a detective on Catalina Island, as I was the only station detective. Yeah. Yeah. I was there for 8 years. A lot of people goes, oh, that was an easy assignment. Actually, it wasn't. There was a lot of stuff going on. You know, you have the tourism crime during the summertime. And in the wintertime, the locals don't have anything else to do except commit crime. A huge drug problem, both on the local side and the tourism side. And so that was fun, kept me busy. A lot of property crime. Hmm. So that kept me busy. I left there and went to Compton, where I stayed as a detective and eventually became a team leader. So I was mentoring new detectives. And my wife likes to rub it into my side that some of the detectives that I mentored then are now captains on the Sheriff's Department now. Thank you very much.
People keep advancing, yeah. Yeah.
And you're just a sergeant. So.
Yeah, that's funny.
I promoted to sergeant out of Compton and went to a countywide unit where we patrolled the county parks in Los Angeles County. Similar to Riverside County and San Bernardino, they have huge parks.
Yeah.
And they also have Los Angeles County in South L.A., probably every couple of miles, there's what they call pocket parks. So it's just a block or two blocks long. They'll have a pool. And they're right in the middle of gang territory. And so you always get the Hispanic gangs, and you have the black gangs going all each other, and you have the Crips and the Bloods fighting each other.
Yeah, right. Right.
So that was kind of fun. And, after the summer of 2022, one of the things with Parks Bureau was, the Board of Supervisors would beef up the patrolling, the personnel during the summertime. And the way they did that was through overtime. And so it was a great overtime assignment for people that wanted it.
Yeah.
And we got people from the courts all the way through the SWAT team guys that would come. And the only prerequisite is that you had to be patrol trained. And these guys, after the summer of about, I think, 1 week, and I supervised like 65 guys, one sergeant for 65 people, spread throughout one third of Los Angeles County. And it's it's crazy. And by the end of the summer of 2012, I was done. I was just physically, mentally done, and kind of held on we had a shooting in one of the parks, so I spent a lot of time in the after action report on that. And then March came over, December came along, and I told my boss, I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in February, I took a month off of sick time. And then in March, I retired. It was great. And one of the things that when I retired is my wife says, we're moving to San Diego County. She specifically said, we're moving to Oceanside.
Yeah.
We'd been here before.
And that's where you are.
Yeah. One of the nice things is about living on Catalina Island is we were boaters, and I had a 30-foot sailboat. And so we spent time in Oceanside Harbor and in and around downtown Oceanside and thought it was kind of cool. So this is where we lived or live now. And we like it. One of the best things is it's next to a relatively small Marine Corps base.
Just that little one, Camp Pendleton. Yeah.
Yeah. Just a small one. And the reason I bring up Camp Pendleton is because that kind of segues into why I'm doing what I'm doing now.
Yeah.
So when we first moved here, we had work done around the house and stuff done. And some of the guys that were delivering equipment to us and doing other things for us were separated Marines. And before I ever talked to these guys, I had a very negative opinion on suicide. You know, I thought if you're sick, it's selfish and everything like that. And I had no opinion on post-traumatic stress. I just thought everybody was weak, you know, suck it up buttercup type attitude,
the attitude that
we always have. And talking to these guys, I started realizing, you know, this thing is real. And there's got to be something done about it. And I've talked to more and more over a 5-year period. And then after my dad passed away in 2018, my wife was diagnosed with lung cancer. All of the stuff that I had built up inside of me for 31 years.
Yeah.
Just came up.
Yeah.
And then I, somewhere along the line in the same time period in 2018, I found out that more law enforcement officers die by suicide every year than in the line of duty.
Yeah.
So that shook my core, and I go, something's really got to be done about this. And I started just writing little Facebook posts. And when I decided something has to be done about this, it's also to the point of, you know, there's not going to psychologists and doctors and stuff like that. There has to be a faith-based solution to it.
Yep.
And so I started, you know, I've been a Christian for as long as I can remember. So I started going through the Bible and looking at different scriptures and putting a faith-based type of scenario to it. And I was just writing short Facebook posts.
Yeah.
And then I met you.
Changed everything.
And you politely told me, and it was the probably really good advice of starting a website. And I did, and now I blog monthly on first responder issues. First responders include obviously cops, corrections officers, firefighters, medics, dispatchers. I mean, the person who gets the call first, the unseen hero is what we call them. You know, they get the call first, and they're the ones that can't do anything. They can't help. They're just getting the information on their head and passing it on. So it's difficult on them.
Yeah.
So last year, November 6th was a very, very bad day for the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. 4 people in a 24-hour period died by suicide. 2 were sworn deputy sheriffs. One of them was a commander on the department, and that would be similar to like a major or light colonel in the military. And he had 30 some odd years or pushing 30 years on the department. The second one was a jailer, a deputy who worked the custody. The third one was a custody assistant or a corrections officer. And the fourth one was a retired deputy, all in a 24-hour period, died by suicide. And what makes it worse was in a 30-day period prior to that, one other retired deputy had committed suicide or died by suicide. And so that makes 4, 5. And in the first 4 months of 2023, 5 other Los Angeles County deputy sheriffs died by suicide. So It just shook. It shook not only the department. I think it shook law enforcement nationwide when they find out about that. And you know, that marks about just under 10% of law enforcement suicides from one department.
Yeah.
And you know, I look into it. In the first 70 days of this year, there have been 21 law enforcement, 4 firefighters, and 1 medic suicides.
Can I stop you right there? Because there's a really interesting thing I think people don't understand about suicide reporting in the first responder community specifically. When we talk about veteran suicide, you know, we use that number of 20 or 22 a day. The Department of Defense has their numbers. And I talk about this a lot. Recent studies done by, there's a big study that was just done by America's Warrior Partnership, it's called, and they did this with a couple of universities. And looking at underreporting, you know, some of these other things, they take that 22 number and they put it up to like 40 or 44. We just don't know exactly. But when you take car accidents and drug overdoses and some of those things that would be ruled as accidental death, if there's intention behind it, it becomes a suicide. Often that's not reported that way. States don't always report. Not every state reports the status of a person who takes their life, as in were they a veteran? So we don't know exactly, but it's a lot easier to hone in on some of these numbers. We can at least get in the ballpark. But with law enforcement specifically, and in the first responder community, there is not nationwide reporting. A lot of underreporting, and I'd love for you to talk about that, but underreporting because, I mean, a lot of reasons, but one is if your coworker is the one who took his life and you know their family and you're the one who responds, it's a lot easier for you to say this was an accident or something than to say it was suicide, you know, to spare the family, to help the family. And then departments don't always necessarily put that data out. So when you give those numbers, this is my point, when you give those numbers, as terrible as they are, they probably don't reflect the actual size of the problem. Is that fair to say?
That is definitely fair to say. In the past, and this was up until even before I retired, there would be a department suicide from, let's just say Los Angeles County. A police officer from a small city would die by suicide. And typically, unless you're a large police department, you're going to have the sheriff's department assist you in homicide investigations. Mm. So, or in death investigations.
Yeah.
And for the most part, a lot of the known suicides were reported as an accidental shooting.
Right.
One department, the officer dropped his Glock. And they say he dropped his Glock, it hit the asphalt, a round went off, and it hit him in the head. Yeah, right. Okay. Right.
Yeah.
You could drop a Glock a million times, it's never going to fire.
Right.
And there was another one, a guy on the sheriff's department. He was a range instructor. And the official homicide report was that he died by accidental shooting while he was cleaning his gun.
Yeah. Right.
And
right.
You know, a range instructor, really? I could see it if it was a trainee, you know, right. second week of the academy,
yeah.
You know, never seen a gun, but a range instructor and things like that were popping up. Well, that was all part of the stigma. And the stigma part of that is that if you die by suicide, you lose all your benefits. Your family's not going to have any benefits and you don't get it. And that's not true.
Yeah.
And eventually,
but that's important to say because on the outside, I can hear that and say, well, they're not reporting. It's just to cover something up, right? It seems almost, I don't know. It's real shady. Like they're just trying to cover up or cover for themselves. That's not the case. I mean, these people love each other and they want to do what's best, even if that means saying he died cleaning his weapon, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are like legitimate reasons and, you know, some of those have been decided or determined to be false or whatever, but the stigma around that, I think people are trying to protect each other, not necessarily even protect the department.
Yeah, it's more of a protection of the family.
Yeah,
and like you said earlier, you know, your partner dies by suicide, and you're the first one to see it. You're going to do your best to for the family.
Yeah,
and there's up until 2 years ago, about 5 years ago, an organization called Blue Help came about. the wife of a officer who died by suicide, started it, and Blue Help started tracking law enforcement suicides. So they were the official place where you would go to report a law enforcement suicide. Now they do suicide reporting for corrections, dispatchers, fire, and law enforcement.
Yeah.
And we know, that it's far underreported because of the people just don't report it.
I mean, right. Right.
They don't want to have another gun-related death in their county or something like that or whatever. And then on the fire department side, there's an organization called the Firefighter Behavioral Health Alliance. They have been tracking and taking reports on reported firefighter suicide and medic suicides for I don't know how long, but quite a while. And then about 2 years ago, a bill was signed into law that it's a tracking law, and the FBI would start tracking law enforcement or first responder suicides, specifically law enforcement suicides, just so they can get a better idea of what's really happened. But when you go into suicide tracking, you know, it's the same thing on the military side. You know, active duty people die every day by suicide. But then you have your veterans and your retirees.
Yeah.
You know, well, the retirees, the veterans, a lot of them aren't sticking a gun to the side of their head and pulling the trigger. A lot of them are dying by other means, basically by self-medication.
Right.
By letting their self go. They just become couch potatoes. And that's the same thing on the retired side as a first responder. A lot of first responders die in the first 10 years by alcoholism, by drug addiction, by obesity, all kinds of things, by cardiovascular health. And this is all because they didn't take care of themselves.
Yeah.
And that's a form of suicide.
Yeah.
So it's.
So, so suicide is like, you know, and I always talk about the spectrum, right? Like there's a spectrum. Suicide is the far end of the spectrum. But I don't think that necessarily encompasses the whole problem, because there are a lot of people who don't take their lives, but their quality of life, their relationships, you know, on and on. And you talk about a lot of that. You do talk about suicide, but you talk about a lot of the other issues. Talk about some of those other issues that, if not addressed, can lead to this kind of far end of the spectrum.
Oh, yeah. There's a whole bunch of things. There's a lady, she's has a PhD in organizational leadership and management. Her name is Olivia Johnson. She started the Blue Wall Institute. Hmm. And she coined the phrase the Fatal 10. And these things have been around for a long time. I think she's just one of the many people that have put this together and put it out there. But the top 10 indicators of suicide ideation is what she calls it. And it's a top 10 things. There's one of them is relationship problems. Interpersonal relationships, separations, divorce, split ups, all lead to problems. I mean, your wife leaves you, you're going to go, you're going to be depressed. And I don't know anybody, even though they're going to get a divorce, actually has a good time when they're going through it.
Right.
And, you know, I mentioned substance abuse earlier. In the first responder professions, we medicate. Everybody self-medicates somehow, some way. That's just what cops and firefighters do. In fact, alcohol is very deeply ingrained in the law enforcement culture.
Right.
And this goes back to, you could watch every movie, every Joseph Wambaugh movie has alcohol involved with the cops. Just about every TV show except for Adam 12 will show cops drinking.
Right.
And in one Adam 12 episode, it did show Sergeant McDonald loading a case of beer into a car. Yeah, that was about as far as that goes. But even in the TV show Homicide: Life on the Street, which depicts the homicide crew from Baltimore, Maryland, the homicide detectives there own the bar they drink at.
Right.
That's just how it is. It's really deep. There was a study by the University of Phoenix, and they took a group of new hire police officers and went through them over a 5-year period. And in the beginning, there was no drinking problem. And at the end, there was a substantial drinking problem.
In 5 years.
In 5 years.
Wow.
And, you know, they attributed it to some of it to the stress of the job. So when you get off work, you go out and hang out with the guys. They attributed that because when you first get hired, you have no stress of the job. And in 5 years, you've seen enough.
Yeah.
And so they'll attribute it to that. But it's also well known that at least 30% of all suicides are alcohol related.
Wow.
And I think most of the ones that I've seen in my career were alcohol related. You know, I talked about the stress. Stress is another indicator. Just the constant stress, everyday things. You know, we have organizational stress where you have to deal with your bosses, and a lot of times the people above you, not so much your sergeants and lieutenants, but your captains and above, they're not on the same page as you are because they're inside a building. They're up in their ivory tower per se, and while you're on the street doing the job. And, so you get that. They want you to do one thing. You know, you can't do it because it's impossible to do. And so you're going to do the best you can on your way of doing it. And you just don't see eye to eye. And that causes a lot of friction even and stress.
Yeah.
But you also have, just the relational stress, the everyday things. You know, the average person will go through maybe 5 or 6 very stressful incidents in their whole entire life. They will see that. The average police officer will do thousands.
Yeah.
I will,
yeah.
In one day, I would tap out on things that normal people don't see. You know, and that's 5 or 6 instances a day you can see that.
Yeah.
And so that just constantly builds up. And what people do, or what, especially in the first responder arena, is we compartmentalize it. So we just shove it down, you know, forget it, and move on because you don't have time. And when you get into stressful situations, as soon as that situation ends, it might take 30, 40 minutes for you to calm back down, for a normal person to calm down.
Yeah.
Where in 30 or 4 minutes in a radio car or, you know, on patrol, you don't have 30 or 4 minutes because as soon as one incident's over, especially working in a big city, you're going to be going to another incident.
Yeah.
And it's really no different for, you know, the 5 or 10 or 15 man rural police department. They have the same stress as we do, as the big city cops. So it's all relational, and it's just a hard pill to swallow. And that's what you do is you just like, you stuff it down, you know, sleep disorders. And that's something we'll get into in a little bit, but that's another one of the top 10, issues. And matter of fact, Colonel Dave Grossman has said numerous times that lack of sleep is the number one cause of suicide among soldiers, airmen, Marines, and law enforcement.
Yeah.
Depression. About 35% of law enforcement officers are known to have post-traumatic stress. And around 30% suffer from severe depression.
Wow.
And so, you know, depression can just...
Sure, yeah.
There's no easy way to say where depression is, because it's just a one-way trip down into the darkness. And our whole thing is to get out of the darkness. Some of the issues that I've seen, and this was a friend of mine who I went to the academy with, worked with, he was medically retired and died by suicide. So when you're medically unfit for duty, when you go to work because you're depressed and your boss sees that you're depressed, so he sends you to a psychologist, and this doesn't refer to California. California's a little bit different, but in a lot of states, you get sent to a psychologist, and then you come back, and the psychologist gives your boss the diagnosis of you, and your boss goes, well, we're going to relieve you of duty, take your gun and badge, and because you were unfit to work. Now, law enforcement and firefighters, when you get hired, that's your identity. That is you for 30 years or for your career. And so you take a guy and tell him he's medically unfit for duty. You take away his gun, and you take away his badge, and you take away his identity, and you stick him out there. That's a one-way trip right into depression and to suicide ideation.
Yeah.
And like I said, a friend of mine that I worked with died by suicide after he was medically retired. Some of the things, especially with cops, is that we have access to firearms.
Right.
And you get in some of these states. I think Montana's one of them, and some of the northern states where it snows all winter long and you don't see asphalt for 6 months. There's a high suicide rate. And in I believe it was Montana, their suicide rate by firearms, it shows that they have a huge firearm problem, because that's how they reported. It's a gun related crime first, and then it's a suicide.
Right.
Firearms, access to firearms. I think they said 86% of law enforcement officers who die by suicide die with a firearm.
Yeah. Correct.
Whereas the general population is about 54%. Internal affairs investigations or criminal investigations is another indicator. You're going to get disciplined. I can tell you, I'll be honest, I did just under 30 days. In my career, I did about 30 days on the bench, is what we called it. Crashing cars and other stupid stuff that you do.
Yeah, it's like a day a year. I mean, that's not terrible.
that's not too bad, but I know guys that did 30 days and got fired. And LAPD, yeah. they hand out some horrendous. They'll give you 6 months off just because, but that stuff is when you get suspended, you don't get paid, you don't have any benefits. And that works on guys. And then guys will go, another guy that I went to the academy with, I had four people in my academy class die by suicide.
No way.
Another guy, he was in patrol
in
South LA and got into a mess. And he was just at the very beginning of an investigation, and he died by suicide at his station, where he shot himself in the head in the locker room.
Wow.
And, it was an pending investigation coming up, and he didn't want to deal with it. And he thought his only way out was what he did.
Yeah.
And then, the pending and actual retirement. Two of the deputies that died by suicide last year from LA County were retired. And with these, your life's taken away. You're stripped of your identity. In 2019, a deputy chief from the New York Police Department, he had 30 some odd years on the department. He was being forced out. And I believe with New York PD, it was 65 years old. And then even if he was in command staff, he had to retire. He was being forced out. So 3 weeks before his retirement, he died by suicide. And the reason was he was losing his identity.
Yep. Yeah. That's all he had ever done.
Yeah, exactly. And in January of 2019, in the city of Long Beach in Los Angeles County, a sergeant who had been retired for 2 years walked into his station where he worked at, walked into the detective bureau where he was a sergeant at, and died by suicide. Because,
incredible.
And there's a separate issue with retirement. I wrote a blog on it. And in the first responder community, when you retire, you walking away from all your friends. Now, I have a couple of friends that I stay close with. I'm actually going to a reunion next month with other retired deputy sheriffs. And this is a once a year thing where you can commingle with your old friends and acquaintances.
Yeah.
It's fun. But the day to day, you don't have the day to day conversations that you would with your old partners and stuff like that. And that builds on people. I call it a friendly divorce, because they know who you are. They'll say hi to you. They'll nod their head to you, and then that's over.
That's right.
And, if you look at the can't think of the name. There was a Wamba movie where Stacy Keach played a well-known officer within the department. He retired, and he went back to the station where he worked at. Nobody had time for him, and then he ended up dying by suicide.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's other life altering events. You've got two kids that are out of the house now, and in a couple more years you are going to be an empty nester.
Yes. That's what they say.
Yeah. And when your kids move out, a lot of people feel like, wow, what do I have now? It's too quiet around here, and I'm not retired yet, and it's just a loss. Even, when you lose a child, a brother, a parent, I've lost two of the three. It's painful. It does hurt when your parents die, or when a brother or a sister dies.
Yeah.
And then, there's other issues. Right now, I told you that my wife has cancer. You know that anyway, but she has, stage 4 lung cancer, which metastasized to her brain. She is deemed cancer-free, but there are still a lot of issues that go with that.
Sure.
And trust me, that does not set well. It's every day is a struggle for her. Every day is a struggle for me, just getting through it. And it's a difficult to do, but I have guys like you that push me in the right direction with the right information. So that works out good.
I was going to say, with the scope of your career, so you outline all these things and talk about these things. Do you think the problem has gotten bigger, or are we just, we're aware of it? It's, you know, the veteran community, you can trace post-traumatic stress symptoms, authors writing about it and so forth back into antiquity. I mean, you know, ancient writings talking about what we would call now symptoms of post-traumatic stress. They didn't identify it that way. They just thought that somebody had broken, right, or something. So I have to assume the problem was big, but now we're looking at it and we're counting it and trying to understand it. Is that the same in law enforcement, or has it actually gotten worse?
I think it's just beginning to get attention.
Yeah.
You say that, you know, King Saul, I think, was where they first documented some type of illness related to stress. I think it was him, maybe a little bit before him. Could have been Abraham, but I don't know. I wrote an article about it, and it's documented in one of my blogs.
That's so go read the blog.
That's the hard part. I have 5 years worth of blogs.
Yeah, right. That's right.
And to remember all that is a little difficult. But in the law enforcement community, suicide is something that you don't talk about. It's something we all know about, but it's something that we don't talk about. And it's mental health training. In 1981, you didn't hear about it. We had someone during the academy from our psychological services unit come in, and that was just at the time, I think they had five psychologists. The Sheriff's Department had five psychologists on hand. And they'd come in, and they'd talk to you, and they'd say, well, you know, if you're stressed, work out. If you're this,
yeah,
you know, whatever. Yeah. If you have marital problems, come and see us. And if you have any other type of mental problems, never even discussed anything about suicide.
Yeah.
Or post-traumatic stress or anything of what we're going to. Now, in early 2000, and I believe this was done for a presentation to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, a person from it changed from psychological services to the employee services center. Okay. So it's still a handful of psychologists.
Yeah.
The psychologist came up, and what she came up with is that a department the size of the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, which is basically the same size as the Los Angeles Police Department or the same size of the California Highway Patrol, one third of the size of New York PD and half the size of Chicago PD. So those are the top five law enforcement agencies. So a department around 10,000 sworn could expect 2 suicides per year. And to me, that just like really, you know, we train all the time. We're always training on officer survival tactics and officer survival events. And you know, there's a police officer gets killed someplace. You're going to talk about it for days. You know, last year, Riverside Sheriff lost 2 officers in 30 days.
Yeah.
And that was a huge, I'm sure it's still a huge discussion.
Yeah.
Among the troops.
And you know this, but my son was at the Riverside County Sheriff's Academy when that happened. And so they have a course of instruction, but they took, I think, 2 or 3 days, paused their course of instruction and went reviewed, watched video, talked about what could have been done and all of that. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're going to use that as a learning experience for sure.
But what's weird is, and I've talked to some friends that are still active, and after the 4 suicides in one day, the response from the management was crickets.
Yeah.
Nothing. You know, like I said, it's a train issue. You think 2 officers a year from a department the size of 10,000, that's unheard of. In the last 10 years, from 2013 to 2023, in that 10-year period, only 2 Los Angeles deputy sheriffs were murdered. One a couple of months ago and one in 2016. And that's on those issues, there was training, there was this, there was that. But on the four suicides? Nothing. And it's just crickets all the time. And when you get to there, the guys are feeling that the brass doesn't support them. And that's the organizational betrayal thing where, you know, the community betrays them, and that going through that right now just because of the events that occurred in 2020. And then, you know, you start feeling hopeless. You get starting to feel a little guilty about things, and there's violations of your moral and ethic values. And, that will drive guys down into just a feeling like there's no support.
When you look at all of this, and whether it's from personal experience or, you know, you talk to a lot of people who have, you know, whether they're professionals or they've just experienced this themselves, what are the top things that you would say to a guy, a girl, a man or woman who's struggling with this? Here are the pieces that you need to get in place. Here's what you need to do. I would say if you're struggling, or, you know, and again, we're friends. We've been friends for a long time. And, you know, my son's a police officer. You've talked to him an awful lot before the academy, in the academy, now that he's out. And so you've given this advice to him, right? So whether someone's struggling or they're going to struggle because they're in this world, what are the things they need to watch out for? What are the things they need to be doing to stay healthy and whole as they serve their communities?
Communication is probably the biggest thing. And a story I'll tell, it happened in the late 80s when I was working in East LA. I primarily, when I was there, worked the graveyard shift from about 11 at night to 7 in the morning. But when I became a training officer, I went on to the swing shift. And there was a guy on the swing shift I knew. We were acquaintances. I mean, we weren't friends. It was a high and by type of thing as we did shift change and everything. Yeah. And all of a sudden I'm on his shift. And when you go from one shift to another shift, you're like the new guy. And he came up to me one night and he goes, "Can I talk to you?" And we just sat in his car for about an hour. Yeah. And he spilled out everything. He just said, "I'm going through this. I'm having financial problems. I'm having wife problems. There's no overtime. You know, I'm not sleeping good. The kids are pissing me off." All kinds of issues that he just, over an hour. And we just talked. And I, you know, like I said, guy's an acquaintance. He's someone I just say hi and bye to.
Yeah.
But at the end, he felt relieved. I guess I felt better. I just had a whole bunch of stuff. But it's nice when you can just talk to someone you know. Peer counseling is probably a greater advantage of healing than psychological counseling.
Mm.
And there's been numerous. I wrote an article called Shots Fired. And it talked about officer-involved shootings. And one officer-involved shooting, the guy said before he died by suicide, he said that he had more help talking to his peers about the shooting than he did the psychological help that he got. He said the psychological help was a joke. And I can attest to that. I was involved in the shooting. The psychological help I got was a joke.
Yeah, sure.
It's 20 minutes in, goodbye, you know. Yeah. And so peer counseling is probably the best thing. Just talk. Talk about your issues. Ask people, you know, you see someone depressed or someone down, ask them, "What's going on? Are you okay? You want to go have a cup of coffee? Let's go to lunch. Talk." And communication is it. The something that people don't do, which is actually it's helpful, is if you see someone that is off balance or something, just say, "Are you thinking about hurting yourself?"
Yeah. Ask the question.
And nobody does it. And that's why I start, and you've heard me say this several times, you know, stomp the stigma, start the conversation. Yeah. And that's what all you got to do is start the conversation. Talk to people about it. Talk to you start the conversation anyway, when you go to your presentations and everything, especially to the military and veterans, you know, that's what you're talking about. You're talking about helping yourself and you're inviting people into the conversation. And that's what law enforcement first responders do.
Yeah.
That's good. In the 90s, when I was working up in the Antelope Valley, Lancaster, Palmdale area, there was a traffic accident on the east end, the far east end of the city of Palmdale at the time. So it was six miles east of downtown. And I was at the sheriff's substation there in my car writing a report, getting ready to go turn it in. And a call came out of a traffic accident on the east end, and it actually was about 8 miles away. And the way the sheriff's department would put out a call is they'd try to find closest unit to get to the call, and then they eventually would hire or give the call to it. Like in this instance, it would have been a traffic car. And I'm hearing the call go out, and no one's acting up on the call. And I finally grab the mic and say, I'll be there in about 6 minutes, code 3, the red lights and siren. And I drive right by the fire station because it was across the street, right by the fire station that they're responding to. And their apparatus doors were still closed. They didn't get the call yet.
Oh, wow.
And I go up and I get to the scene. I make a long story short. The driver of a car that ran a red light at 55 miles an hour, she was obviously dead. Her three kids who were buried underneath the front seat of the car, they eventually died. And the people in the car that had the right of way, they had suffered no injuries. It was wild. Wow. They were in a Jeep Cherokee. At the time I didn't know Jeep Cherokees had roll bars. But it was just sad, and it was difficult at the time. It was on a Sunday actually too, and I tried to get the equipment there. I was always told if you need it, you got it, you know. And then I find out we're the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. It's more like the Marine Corps, you know. You need it, you're not going to get it. So
yeah, right. We don't have it. We'd give it to you if you had it, but we don't.
Yeah. And it eventually got all kinds of actually more cops there to help out, and we had two paramedic squads.
Yeah.
And a rescue helicopter with a doctor on board and all that. And the three kids actually died in the helicopter en route to the hospital.
Wow.
And afterwards, you know, I'm sitting there. The kids are gone. The traffic investigator's doing his thing. I'm just sitting there still writing the report I left off before I got the call and helping out the traffic guys, because I'm a traffic trained officer anyway, helping them out. And I could see people sitting up on the block walls behind their houses, and they're just gawking at this lady because she's, like I said, she's obviously dead, knelt over in her car, and the coroner hadn't been there yet, and they're just kind of gawking at her and laughing and making jokes, and it's like, he's sick. You guys are just sick.
Yeah, yeah.
And eventually, when I cleared the scene, I went to Fire Station 37s, and they had the battalion chief had already had someone from their psychological services unit. They're at the station. The station was closed, and they had someone in there talking to them and discussing the issues with them. And I was impressed by that, because that didn't happen on the sheriff's department.
Yeah.
You know, I get back to the station at, I think I got back like 4 or 5 o'clock. I immediately go home, pick up my wife and drive to church because I was going to Lancaster Baptist Church at the time. And because I wasn't the early morning service or the morning service, we were doing the evening service.
Yeah.
Went to church and cried my eyes out in front of Jerry Furso, associate pastor.
Yeah.
So you and Jerry Furso, the only two guys outside of my close interpersonal circle, have ever seen me cry.
But it's an honor to be named among that group. So that scenario you described, I mean, that's law enforcement, right? And then you go back to work the next day and get back into it. And it's not like it never happened, but you just have to push it down so you can do your job.
Yeah, and exactly. And, you know, there was another incident that happened in Lancaster, basically the same thing. I'm 10, 20 minutes before I get off work. A call goes out of a baby with a head injury. And it keeps going to any unit and so-and-so. They're going any unit in 2 minutes, any unit in 3 minutes. I finally grab the radio, say my call letters in 4 minutes, basically from the station. And I knew where the house was already, the street and everything. And back then we had Chevy Caprices that went really fast. Like I said to Chris Lintrell on one of his podcasts one time, I wanted to be a cop so I could drive fast and take people to jail. You know? So, you know, I get to the scene and I'm thinking, well, the fire station, there was like a half a mile away. Fire will be there before I get there. I get on the street. There's no fire department there. I get to the house. Okay. It's a baby with a head injury. Okay. So what could that mean? But as I get out the car, you get this eerie feeling going through your body. And it's the spirit going through me, and it says, this is something worse. So I get up to the door, and usually on rescue calls, especially rescue calls with kids, there's activity. Doors are open. People are screaming.
Sure.
I'm pounding on the door, yelling, Sheriff's Department. Lady comes down, She opens up the door and goes, my son's upstairs. I get to the top of the stairs into her bedroom, and her 11-year-old son, he's laying on the floor on his back. He's facing, or his head's pointing in the northerly direction. On his right hand is a stainless steel 6-inch 357 Magnum. On the left side of his head is his brain.
Yeah.
And you don't unsee that.
Yeah.
That was in 1996.
Yeah.
You know, I'm talking about it today like I'm there. unsee those things. So, and it turns out that his father was a firefighter for Los Angeles City Fire Department.
Wow.
So eventually, about an hour later, a PM shift or swing shift unit comes on, relieves me, and they handle the report and take care of everything. But I get to go back to the station, put gas in my car, fill out an overtime slip, argue with the watch commander over 1 hour of overtime because they didn't want to give it to me. And then go home and live a normal life. And, hi, honey, how you doing today?
Yeah, that's right.
And it's I just stuffed it down. The next day, you do it again.
Yep.
There was a time in Lancaster where in three-day periods, I had three baby not breathing calls, basically three dead baby calls, one every day. And the dispatcher told me, if we have another one, you're not going to get it. Even if you're standing at the front door, you're not going to
get it. Right. We're not sending you. But, and that's where talking about it's helpful, right, is just intentionally sitting down with somebody and just kind of offloading that.
Yeah, when you talk about stuff, you're draining it out of your system. One of the things, like how I communicate, is obviously writing blogs.
Yeah.
And while I don't – I just told you two occasions of things – that I normally don't talk about. It would be very difficult for me to talk about those things to just anybody on the street or most of my friends that are not law enforcement related, because they wouldn't understand.
Yeah.
And so I write blogs about it. And that way I can talk about, hey, you know, I'm feeling this way today. And so this is what I'm going to write about.
Yeah.
And
Yeah, man, that's good. There's so much there. One of the other areas you wrote about, I think your most recent blog was on sleep, but you talk about, you know, just taking care of yourself. I mean, that's one of the things that you spend time talking about. What are the keys there? So, you know, sleep, I think you mentioned this, but, in the post-traumatic stress world, right, where I spend a lot of my time talking, sleep is the number one, help for someone to, you know, recover and start to get better and move forward from some of that. I think it's the same there. But when you're talking about sleep, you're talking about just taking care of yourself physically and those kind of things. How important is that for longevity in law enforcement and then even making good decisions after the fact?
Sleep is very important. It's a gift given to us by God for one reason. That's to rejuvenate our bodies.
Yeah.
While we're sleeping, you know, our bodies are relaxing, but our brain and our muscles are re-energizing for the next day.
Mm.
So when you go without sleep for a certain amount of time, all kinds of your bodily systems get messed up. And one of we'll just go with your electrolytes. And you know you're a runner. After a run or on days when you know that your electrolytes are down, you're sluggish.
Yeah.
And you're not thinking properly because you build your electrolytes back up because our bodies are run on electricity. I was reading this morning. We generate just sitting. We generate 100 watts of electricity in our system.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Just by sitting.
Yeah, it's crazy.
When you're on your runs, you're generating, you know, probably upwards of 1,000. Watts of energy, and that's just crazy.
Yeah.
So when we're sleeping, we're rejuvenating everything, and that's just how we are. It's called your circadian system, and it's based on a 24-hour clock, and you have to get sleep. And one thing that Colonel Grossman talks a lot about, two things. The one is light. And we live now in a society where for the last 80 years, we have been probably 100 years now inundated with artificial light. You know, there's been studies with farmers in the Midwest who didn't get electricity up until the late 50s, early 60s, that they had less cancers and less diseases than they do now because
incredible.
There's artificial light. Now, artificial light brings in late nights and lack of sleep.
Yeah.
And what Colonel Grossman says is get your sleep, and where if you can't sleep in a completely dark area or you have to sleep in the day, wear some type of eye covering or blackout shades and everything like that. And there's been several studies that the lack of sleep for just 18 hours, it's the equivalent of a blood alcohol of a 0.05 to a 0.08. Now, and then in California, the legal limit is a 0.08. After 24 hours, your blood alcohol, it's the equivalent of a 0.10 blood alcohol.
Oh, wow.
So that's crazy. Now, how this relates to law enforcement. In the riots in 1992, we were working 22-hour shifts and getting...
That's crazy. That's so crazy.
From the time you started to the time you're in, it was roughly 22 hours. In the 2010-ish, there was a large fire in Los Angeles County called the Station Fire. It burned from Magic Mountain to San Bernardino County. And on those shifts, we were no days off. And I would work one day of 22 hours at the fire scene doing security for the places that we evacuated. And then one day at my unit of assignment, being a detective for 12 hours.
Yeah. Wow.
And that was like that every other day. And by the end of the week, when we finally got relieved, you know, you go home and you really don't catch up on sleep. You just like sleep.
Yeah.
These days, well, I told you the last unit I worked at, it's great for overtime. Well, Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, they limited your overtime to 96 hours a month. So that would basically be a double 8-hour shift or 16 hours, 8, 16, 8, and then your days off.
Wow.
Now they have increased that number to over 120 hours, and they're forcing people to work overtime. So even if you don't want to work overtime, they're forcing you to work up to 120 hours a month.
It's incredible.
You got guys now coming to work that are just tired. They're burnt out.
Yeah.
They're not completely rejuvenated. Their systems are all discombobulated.
Yeah.
And the one of them, the suicides that happened on November 6th, the wife of her husband or the wife of the deputy who died is suing the department because of sleep deprivation. She goes, that is the reason. He was just too tired to go to work, and he was consistently going to work. And that was the number one cause. And that goes back to what Colonel Grossman says is, lack of sleep is a number one cause among airmen, Marines, Army, soldiers, and law enforcement of suicide. It's a great indicator. There was a doctor, can't think of her name right. She, her doctor, Dr. Bernhardt, she's a suicidologist. I mean, what a weird study.
Yeah, right.
She's a suicidologist. She did a 10-year study. She took 20 people, I believe it was 20 people that died by suicide. She studied their traits and then took 200 people that had the same traits as the ones that died. And her group over this 10-year study came up that a sleep-deprived person was 1.4 times a greater risk of suicide than a non-sleep-deprived person.
That's incredible.
And that sleep deprivation is a greater indicator of suicide than depression. And that one is what's like, really, wow. I thought depression was pretty up there, but.
Yeah. Sleep is up as higher. Yeah. Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah. And, you know, you've gone through, you know, when you were deployed, you went probably a very substantial time of no sleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can attest that, hey, this isn't good. This is not healthy. And the only thing you can do is just get sleep. Force yourself to sleep.
Right.
You know, we, now that I'm retired, you work mostly days, but you travel a lot. What you have to do is in your travel is just sit there and take time. Get out, you know, you get back to wherever you're staying. I'm at, don't go online, get off your phone, put everything away and get some sleep.
Yeah.
Blue light is one of the big things they're talking about now. And it's hard on me because what I do is I'll watch TV until about 9:30 I usually turn the TV off around 9-ish, 9:15. Once the news really upsets me, I turn it off.
It's time to move on.
But the iPad's still there, and I go, oh, I can still, because I go to bed at 9:30, between 9:30 and 10. Well, the iPad's still there, so I'll scroll through the, anything going on Facebook. And so that I just inundated my light, my night with all this blue light.
Yeah.
And then yesterday, setting up, you know, I've got lights all over the place, so I'm setting up to get all the lights right. And so I have all this light in my brain. I go to bed,
right?
And you're not going to go right to sleep. You close your eyes. And so get rid of light about a half an hour before you go to bed. One of the other issues of lack of sleep is caffeine.
Mm.
Caffeine has a half-life of 5 hours. We average between 200 and 400 milligrams of caffeine a day, in general in America.
Yeah.
You drink more caffeine. Well, I can't say you drink more than I do. I drink a lot of iced tea. You drink coffee.
Yeah. I drink a lot of coffee. Yes. Yeah. I get more than that 400 milligrams for sure.
Yeah. You get your coffee. I drink a lot of iced tea.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you have to be cognizant of after 12 o'clock, don't drink anything with caffeine in it.
Mm.
Because with a half-life of 4 or 5 hours, by the time you're getting ready for bed, that caffeine's still active in your system.
Mm.
And energy drinks, because of the caffeine in those, are even worse. Not only are they bad for your heart, but they're loaded with it. They've probably got as much caffeine in one monster drink than you drink all day in your coffee. So.
Yeah, not to mention the sugars and everything else that's in
so that those. Just amps you all up, and you're not going to sleep for that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, sleep, it's weird, but it leads to obesity. And what it does is when you're not getting enough sleep, you're hijacking your system, your HPA, your hypopituitary, or hypothalamus pituitary adrenaline system. What you're doing is basically you're not sleeping. You're putting your body into the fight, fear, or freeze mode, or the fear, fright, fight and fight mode. And what you're doing is you're putting yourself in that. And so you're not sleeping. All you're doing is producing cortisol. Cortisol it's a good drug when used properly. God gave it to us because of the fear reaction.
Mm.
But you're laying in bed, but you're producing cortisol. Cortisol has a weird effect where it's kind of cliche to say it, but it makes you eat bad. You know, you kind of get, you kind of crave sugary things. You kind of crave carbohydrates. I always thought that donut shops were open at 3 a.m. because that was the only place to get coffee. Donut shops were open at 3 a.m. so I could go there and get fat.
Right. Yeah.
And law enforcement, or in the first responder community, period, obesity is huge. Now, what you do is you can't sleep because you're overweight. But you're overweight because you're producing cortisol to make you eat poorly.
Yeah.
And you can't sleep. So it's just a never-ending cycle, and you're getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
And law enforcement or first responders, period, but law enforcement has the highest rate of obesity of any profession in the United States.
Wow. Incredible.
Behind that is the pastorate.
Yeah.
You and Steve Chappell
are exceptions
to it, but the pastorate, it blew me away when I read that. I think they just took John Hagee and used him as their source.
That's incredible. Yeah. But, I mean, a lot of the same stresses, you know, as in dealing with people and dealing with other people's problems. I can understand that. Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah.
And, you know, the statistics now, and I don't know if you read this one or remember it, in law enforcement, the average cop, 50% of policemen will die of some cardiovascular related disease before 5 years of retirement.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen those numbers.
The average police officer has their first heart related issue at age 47.
Man, interesting.
And they die by the age of 57. This is, there was a study out of the University of Buffalo. And several other studies. There's a doctor in Texas who's he's a cardiologist and a police officer. And, he's done numerous studies on obesity and heart related diseases. And that in a weird sense is a way you're dying by suicide at the end is you're not sleeping. You're not taking care of yourself in retirement.
Yeah. You're giving up, right? And that's, you know, kind of what depression and all those other factors that you mentioned push you to, and then you can take your life or you can just kind of give up and those natural processes take over.
There's a study, his name escapes me also, but he's a retired Secret Service officer. And I gave you the book, The Hypervigilant Cycle, whatever, but he added into that. The hypervigilant cycle is when you're just on this up and down thing. Like I used to go to work, I'd get pumped up before I go to work. So when I get there, I'm ready to go. And then throughout your 8 or 10 hour shift, you're going up and down on this roller coaster ride. At the end of your shift, you just can't turn it off. And eventually you're going to crash and burn.
Yeah.
Well, what happens is you're building this cliff. And, you know, in the first couple of 3 or 4 years, like Ethan right now has no cliff to fall off of.
Right.
Eventually it'll be a curb. And then it'll be like a block wall, 8 foot high block wall. Mm. Eventually it's a cliff.
Yeah.
And when you retire, if you retire at 31 years, you're at the top of that cliff. And now you got to figure out how to get back down. And a lot of people, they get into is they just go right off that cliff and into depression and into all these other things. Go get into that dark area.
Yeah.
And they just don't get out. And that's, you got to figure it out at the top. Your saying is march or die. My saying is sink or swim. Or I also use the term stuck on Saturday. You got to get out of that mode and go towards the light instead of into that deep darkness that you're leading into. And getting down from that cliff, 31 years, I'm still getting that down from that ship.
Sure. And that's the next challenge, right? It's kind of a lifelong challenge. There's a lot here. One of the things I appreciate about you is that you're so good at articulating not only the problems, but here are the solutions, right? And you underlie all of that with a faith foundation. People who are listening, where can they connect with your blog and then get your book?
Okay, I wrote a book called Broken, BRO:KEN, and the semicolon represents a pause. In the literary world, writers will use it as a pause of a sentence, so it doesn't mean the end. In the mental health world, it is a pause, so you're not going to the end, which the end would be suicide. And so you're pausing. So that's what that is. It's just a symbol, and it's broken understanding the effects of post-traumatic stress. I call it the who, what, when, why, what you're going through, and it is faith-based. You can get that on Amazon. I'd see it in Kindle and in paperback. And the easiest way to find it is on your search bar in Amazon. Just type in my name, Danny Kuhn, and it'll pop up. Also, my blog is Bulletproof First Responder. It's bulletprooffirstresponder.com. And I try to blog monthly. And usually I get stuff out at the beginning of the month. This year, I'm on a series of wellness. So I did one on next month. My latest one was on sleep. I did one on the work balance, work-life balance.
That's good.
And it's just going to be all just on different wellness subjects for the year. And I've already got them all mapped out, so it's just writing the blogs. And awesome. If you go to my website, on the one page is a podcast page, I believe, and that's where all of the podcasts that I've been guest on where we talk about this issues if you want to learn more. One of the podcasts, I didn't put it on there, is Morning Coffee with the Chief, and that's more of we talk about law enforcement movies. And it's kind of fun to talk about because you're talking about like one movie we talked about was The Onion Field, and that was serious because it had a serious sign. Another one was The Choir Boys, and that was totally different off track of what I'm doing, but they're fun to do and good training for me to talk on camera.
That's good.
But
that's good.
There's a couple of organizations. Let's see if I can find them. That if you need help, to get help. And that's another saying of mine. If you need help, get help. Yeah. People will tell you no. If you need help, they don't know. But one of the organizations, it's called Copline. It is a 24-hour hotline for law enforcement officers, retired law enforcement officers, and their families. And it's staffed by trained law enforcement officers. And what they do is if you have a problem, you give them a call. Everything is confidential. There's no reporting to a department. Matter of fact, when people graduate from Copline, they do not post their names or faces on their website or any, or even when they say that they're having a graduating class, everybody in the group picture, you see the back of their heads. You only see the faces of the instructors. You don't see. And so if you go to that and you get a picture taken with them, that's your picture is going to be the back of their heads.
Yeah.
Because it's completely anonymous. And their phone number is 1-800-COPLINE or 1-800-267-5463. And there's another hotline. It's for firefighters and medics. And again, it's staffed by retired firefighters. And their phone number is 1-800-731-FIRE.
That's good.
So those are two great. There's a couple other ones, but these two are definitely
awesome.
Anonymous.
And that's good.
That's important to keep the anonymity in there because only recently, and I said this earlier, it doesn't happen in California. Only recently has there been legislation, and there's a push now nationwide that if your agency sends you to a psychologist, that is between you and the psychologist. It's a straight doctor patient, where in the past it wasn't like that. And I don't know if the military, if they've changed to those rules or not, but that's definitely.
Yeah, it's supposed to be that way in the military too. I think it becomes a gray area. But it is supposed to be that way as well.
Yeah, and then I'm stealing this from you, but there's a great organization out there. They're internationally based. They deal with issues for first responders and veterans, separated and active duty military, Mighty Oaks. So
yes, Mighty Oaks. Yeah,
they're a great.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, you know this, but we started as a veterans organization, Mighty Oaks did, and there were so many similarities between the struggles in the first responder community and the veteran community that we started, and we have a program going on today, actually, for first responders. And so, yeah, that's been a great opportunity for us. And I think, you know, maybe the biggest thing that's changed in law enforcement, biggest thing that's changed in the military is that there are people talking about it. There are credible people talking about it, which is great. And then there are so many resources and opportunities to get help if you'll just take that step and take it before the bottom falls out. That drives me crazy. I'll talk to people 5 years ago about coming to a program or getting help or connecting to resources or reading your blog, like follow Danny's blog. He's writing about this all the time. And everybody's like, yeah. And then the bottom falls out and it's like, I need help right now, you know? And there's so much we can do ahead of time to, I think, get in front of a lot of this.
Yeah. By spreading the message. I think on average, 14 people per 100,000 is the suicide rate for the general population. In the first responder community, it's upwards of 22 per 100,000. And I believe in your recent book on suicide, for the military side was upwards of 25, maybe 26.
That's right.
The numbers are pretty close together for law enforcement and on the military side. And, you know, I went back and said in the first 70 days there were 25, 26 first responder suicides. Those numbers are actually – they appear to be down from last year. So it's not that reporting is getting bad. Last year numbers were 128 first responder suicides or law enforcement suicides to the year before there was about 180 some odd. So the numbers are coming down, and I think it's because of people like us are talking about it. We're spreading the message.
Yeah.
On the law enforcement side, I like to say that it is a overpopulated arena to be in right now to talk about it, but it's not big enough yet. I mean, it's like, you know, the church on every corner is great, but if you can get a church every 100 feet from each other, to get that message out there more,
is even
more fantastic.
Yeah, more is better until the problem's gone. Yeah. I mean, that's
And it's going to be there because But as long as we can lessen it every year, when you go from 180 some odd to 120 some odd, 60 in a year, that's good. It appears to be down this year so far. Good. We'll see what happens as the year goes on.
That's good.
What's going to be interesting is it seems, I call it the pendulum, and I've seen this swing from one end to the other. Your son will see it several times during his career. Is it'll go from the far right to the far left, where we want it, basically in the middle.
Yeah, yeah.
And for the longest time, we weren't on the far left, but we were a little bit more towards the far left than we were towards the middle. And then in 2020, the bottom fell out, and everything went to the far right. And that is slowly turning around now. The public is starting to realize that, hey, all these stupid laws that we passed and all these things that we did in 2020 aren't working, so let's get back to the way it was. And so that will make – that should calm down some of the issues that the cops are having, because right now they're just felt betrayed. They, you know, when you have a department that can't hire because people don't want to be cops.
Yeah, yeah.
It's under – and on the fire department side, it used to be – I remember one year the L.A. County Fire Department was hiring. Over 2,000 people applied, showed up to take the test.
Yeah.
To get on a list. They weren't even, they were putting a list together. In the 80s, when I was looking to get hired in Orange County, I would test every weekend for a different agency. Wow. All they were doing is putting your name on the list. Mm. And every week when I'd go test, I would see the same 150, 200 people that tested the week before.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we all didn't want to go to LA County. We all wanted to stay in Orange
County. Right. Yeah.
But,
Yeah, things have changed a lot, and hopefully, you know, they are changing for the better, and that pendulum will come back to the middle. But, I appreciate it. I appreciate what you do and how you're doing it. I can't encourage people strongly enough to follow the work that you're doing. It's deep, but it's very helpful, and it's regular, which is nice. You know, it's not like you wrote three blogs and then quit and then came back 6 months later. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you for talking about it. Thank you for doing it. And thanks for talking to me. Finally, we have this conversation a lot, but finally we recorded it. So that's good. So I really appreciate it, man. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. Like I said, it's an honor to be your guest.
Again, thankful for Danny and that conversation, the resources that he mentioned there. I'll tell you this, go to his website, Bulletproof First Responder. He has his blog is there, of course. Wonderful articles. I mean, dealing with every topic, he lays things out so clearly. Everything is backed up with research. And then he presents the problem and will then offer solutions and a path forward. It's very, very helpful. I read every one and I often share them. I'm very thankful for the opportunity to know him, to learn from him. And he continues to produce great content. So please go and check that out. But he also has a list of great resources there. If you need help, get help. If you know someone who needs help, help them get the help that they need. Check out his book as well. Wonderful, wonderful content. So appreciate Danny. Life Audio. I talk about Life Audio often and kind of my switch there. Life Audio. LifeAudio.com is where this podcast is hosted and great podcasts there. So many great topics. And what I try to do with March or Die is I've explained this many, many times, but how do we move forward when life seems overwhelming? How do we move forward when life is out of control? And bring on folks like Danny to talk about issues very specific. Like this one, or very broad life issues. How do we move forward? We talk about these things all the time. And my goal in my heart is to give you something that you can use or can be a help to someone that you know. That's the conversation I want to have. I hope there's entertainment value, but more than anything, I want people to be helped. Life Audio has a ton of podcasts with the same focus. How do we help folks working through various issues, whether it be your own personal relationship with God or parenting or marriage or whatever? There is a podcast there that you can find that will be helpful to you. So please go and check those out as well. Again, as I do always, I try to bring this up every single time we talk. I forget sometimes, but I try. But here it is. When life seems to be out of control, you only have two options. Again, we talk about this today. We talk about this often. You only have two options. You can stay where you are and die. You can give up. You can throw in the towel. You can say, this is it. You can do that. Or you can do the better thing. You can march. What are you going to do? Thank you. I will talk to you next week. Many of our veterans feel they need to fight their battles alone. This self-isolation has led to the staggering statistic of more than 20 veterans taking their lives every day. The mission of Mighty Oaks is to eradicate the veteran suicide epidemic and help our warriors change their legacies. We've been able to help over 4,000 veterans and first responders by equipping them with the tools they need to live the lives they were created to live. Our faith-based, peer-to-peer approach has one of the highest success rates of any program available today, offering hope and understanding to those who need it most. By aligning their lives to biblical principles, these men and women are able to lead their families, their communities, and our nation. It's your generosity that can make a difference in the lives of the men and women who have fought for our country and our freedoms. Now that they're home, don't let them fight alone. Learn more at MightyOaksPrograms.org.
Finding uplifting news in today's headlines is often like searching for a needle in a haystack. At the Story Behind podcast, we believe in the power of finding heartwarming tales and are happy to share empowering stories with you every week. Get inspired by the note a waitress received from a patron dining alone. And even hear about how one VIP passenger made a hardworking pilot get emotional before his flight. To start listening to the Story Behind podcast, visit lifeaudio.com